Blog Talk Radio.
Stroll through the picture, what I've left behind. You once again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Well, good evening, everybody. I would like to invite, welcome you and invite you to join us on the Stop Child Abuse Now Talk radio show sponsored by NASCA, which stands for the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. It is Wednesday, November 17th, 2021. This is scan number 2793. My name is Penelope Dennis, and I'm from Bellevue, Washington. On my host team this evening is John Anderson from Louisiana, and we welcome you to our show tonight. Tonight, the type of show is special guest night, and we have a very, very special guest with us this evening. It is our NASCA sister, Annie Martis. She's from Long Beach, California, and we're so thrilled to have her on, returning NASCA family member. John, I'll tell you a little bit more about Annie in a few minutes, but I wanted to first tell you a little bit more about NASCA and NASCA's mission statement. If you are intrigued about the show and would like to participate in the show this evening, you can do that by joining the show as a panel member. The way to do that is to call into area code 646-595-2118. Again, that's area code 646-595-2118. And John will greet you on our back line and welcome you to the show. And as a panel member, you will have an opportunity to interact with our special guest, Annie, and ask her questions or offer a comment that is regarding her story. So we do encourage you to call in to be a member of the panel, and there is no experience necessary. Just have the eagerness and curiosity to call in and join us as a panel member. I'd like to talk to you a little bit about NASCA, because NASCA is all about child abuse, trauma prevention, intervention, and recovery. We have a single purpose at NASCA, is to address issues related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional trauma and neglect, and we do so with only two goals. The first goal, educating the public, especially as related to helping society get over its taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, presenting facts showing child abuse to be a pandemic worldwide problem that affects everyone. The second goal of offering hope and healing through many paths, such as these shows, providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse, and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. If you'd like to join our panel, I would recommend that you do so. It is as easy as dialing the following number, 646-595-2118. So without further ado, I wanted to tell you a little bit more about how our special guest night shows are organized. It's a 90-minute show that does that very quickly. We like to focus on the three segments. In the first segment, for a special guest night, because it is someone's personal story about their experience, we spend the first third of the show, about the first 25, 30 minutes, in the earliest childhood years, a little bit about family of origin, where the guest was born, who was in the family, to give us some context and paint a picture of their life. as they enter the world. Up until about the age of 18 or so, we'll break to the panel. The panel will have an opportunity to interact during that break with Annie, our special guest. And then we go to the middle segment of the show, which is usually another 20, 25 minutes, talk about the middle years from about the age of 18 to 30. We break to the panel again. The panel has two opportunities during the show to interact with our special guest. And then in the last segment of the show, we talk about recovery, the healing process, what the future holds for the guest, and anything else that they wish to share with us. So we're very much looking forward to hearing about Annie's story tonight. And as I mentioned, Annie Margis is from Long Beach, California. She's a survivor of incest in her childhood. She's also an author and a producer of the film called The Ugliest Word. It's about a little girl who survived childhood incest. As a survivor myself, Annie says, one of the things that gave me strength was my ability to find community through sites like Facebook. Many victims are ashamed of the stigma of abuse that they can never find true healing. She explains, I wrote The Ugliest Word because I realized acknowledging the crime of incest is necessary in fighting it. So I can't wait to hear more about Annie and her story and her work. So without further ado, I'm going to unmute Annie's microphone. And Annie, thank you so much for joining John and me this evening. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for asking me. I really appreciate it.
Well, we appreciate you coming on and sharing your story with us. As you know, it helps so many of us. We're all in different places in our healing journey, and it's just such a gift, I think, that you give to come and share your experience and tell your story to us. It helps everyone. It helps us in our own healing. So I wish to thank you for coming on.
And it helps me to listen to the other nights and hear other stories.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, thank you for that.
So thank you. Mm-hmm. So we'd like to, always start off, because as you know, the shows are archived and they're available and accessible for many of our members around the world. Go back and listen to them for the first time. It helps in the healing process. So we like to have some continuity around the structure of the shows. And if you wouldn't mind, Annie, just giving us an idea of just how you came to this world and where you were born and who was in your family and what your life was like from your earliest memories.
Okay, I will do that. My mother was going to be a nun. She was in the convent when she met my father and got pregnant and got married. And so it wasn't her first choice to be a mother, and she wasn't very good at it. And she had two sons and a daughter already by the time she got pregnant with me. And she was of the school that said, oh, boys are important and you have to have a boy and girls aren't so important. She totally believed in that. And she already had two boys.
Mm-hmm.
And she had one girl. She didn't need more girls than one. But then there was me. And when I was born, my mom had pneumonia. I was born in a Catholic hospital, and the nuns put my bassinet outside in the hallway so that my crying wouldn't disturb my sick mother. And I got a staph infection, and I had big boils all over my body. I know this because my mother used to tell me this story and laugh.
Mm-hmm.
So I had these boils all over, and I went home and I gave the boils to my sister and my brothers and my parents, mm-hmm. and my grandparents. Everybody got this stuff, and it was painful. And everyone hated me because I was the one who gave it to them. And no one wanted to pick me up. My mother told me these things. No one wanted to pick me up because I had stuff on me.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my start, and I fast forward to when I was 3 years old. I remember sitting on a chair where my feet wouldn't touch the ground because I was too little. And my father sexually assaulted me. And I remember it very clearly. I have very clear pictures of it. And I have a lot of other clear memories of assault as well. And I don't know how many years it went on. I know that it started when I was very little. I remember him holding me in my arms and molesting me. So I was little. So I don't know how long it continued. When I was in the fifth grade, so I was about 10 or 11, I had what they used to call their quit fifth grade. I kept getting strep throat over and over again, which apparently is some kind of psychosomatic thing, but I'm not sure. That's what they said. And I was delusional. I was delusional at this time. My delusion was that I believed that every breath I took was a sin, and it was a sin against my father. It wasn't rational. I thought there were sins everywhere, and if I touched them, then I got sinful, and I developed compulsive hand washing, and that lasted for a long time. And in this delusion, I believed I was the greatest sinner that had ever lived because I just had sins all over me. And so I went to confession, and I tried to tell the priest that I had sinned like a million, billion, trillion times. And he gave a little laugh, you know, and he said, "Oh, you're not such a bad little girl. Just go home and do what your father tells you." So that was it. I was damned. Go home and do what my father tells me to do. The priest wants me to do that. And yet if I don't do what he tells me to do, I'm damned. Because you have to do what your father says. So it was confusing, and my mind definitely cracked during this time. The way it ended was going into the sixth grade. It was really me. I ended it. I really believed this. What I did was, I reasoned that as long as I was going to go to hell anyway, as long as I was already damned, I might as well give up trying to please God and just accept it. Accept the sins on my hands. Don't wash them anymore. And so I actually quit the hand washing and the sin counting, and I went back to school. And during my spell of insanity, I must have done some fancy brain rewiring, because when I came out in the sixth grade, I had no memories of abuse at all. This probably made high school easier for me, because I had no memory of abuse.
Wow.
Yeah. And that...
Wow.
You know, that's definitely something we can talk about later for sure, because, you know, there's a lot that comes into this later, I'm sure, and I can't wait to hear it.
Shall I go on?
Yes. Thank you.
Okay. So the next stage in my life.
I'm sorry, Annie. Actually, I just wanted to ask you a couple questions, and I'm sorry to interject. I changed my mind. I'm a mind changer. But you said, so, you know, I had a couple questions about what you just shared with us. And the first thing was, did your mother have any knowledge of your father's sexual abuse towards you as a baby? You know, as a young,
yes,
she did.
I don't know how old I was when she learned. But I wasn't the only one who was assaulted sexually. My big sister and my little sister. And my brothers don't talk about it. So I don't know about them. Mm-hmm. But I'm pretty sure that one of my brothers was assaulted, because I kind of remember, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and my mother did know at one point, because I asked her a question about what was going on, and she said, "None of your business, never mind." I remember that conversation. Yeah.
Wow.
That's quite extensive right there. It really is. Unbelievable.
Right. Well, it tells you maybe that she was telling herself that the abuse was none of her business. Right, what she's saying to you, what she was saying to herself. Wow.
Yeah, it was nobody's business, right?
Right.
In that memory, it was my brother who was the victim. Mm. So. But the brothers never talked about it.
How old was your oldest brother from you? How old was he?
Two years older than me.
2 years, okay. Yeah. And then you had
another
one.
And then I had
another too,
one,
right?
1 year, 1 year older than me. Yeah.
Okay, so y'all were right in a row.
Very close.
Yeah, she had babies all in a row, and then she miscarried, and then she had two more in a row. So,
okay.
A lot of children. Catholicism, you know, they had to.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, Annie, please continue. I'm sorry to interject, but I did have that question.
No problem. So
But keep on. Yeah, keep on. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I made it through high school, okay, although I was pretty bipolar. I have clear memories of bipolar episodes going on. And I dated a lot of guys. I was kind of popular. But then I found this boyfriend who didn't go to my school and was older. He was out of high school. And very possessive, extremely macho. I liked that. And sure enough, as soon as I turned 18, I got pregnant because he did not respect my no. And today I say it was date rape. I only realized that a few years back, that that's what it was. But it was.
Wow.
But I always blamed myself for being the one who got pregnant. You know, so it was my fault. I want to say that pregnancy often happens to child abuse victims. There's like a way higher rate of teenage pregnancy and single women pregnancy for survivors.
Mm-hmm.
Makes me feel better. I wasn't the only one.
Yeah.
So there I was, 18 and pregnant, little Catholic school. I was out of high school already. I had graduated, but it had only been like 2 months. So, and I went to get the pregnancy test at the I think it was like a county medical center or something like that, and This doctor came out and he said, "You're pregnant. Do you want an abortion?" And it was 1974, and abortions were legal. They hadn't been legal very long. And
right.
So he gave me a choice. I could put all this behind me and still go to college. I could still be a writer. And that moment is etched in my memory, a moment of horror and a moment of peace, because the decision I was going to make was going to decide my future. But I couldn't do an abortion. I was a devout Catholic. I was still very devout at the time. And I knew if I had an abortion, I would feel so guilty, I would kill myself. I knew that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I couldn't be a writer if I killed myself. So I decided, and this is what I did, I carried the pregnancy through to birth, and I gave the baby up for adoption. And, however, I got him back. I went a few months. Yeah, I did. I went a few months, and I realized I couldn't live with it. That everywhere I looked, I'd see kids and babies and stuff, and I knew, no, I can't live like this. And so I said, he's mine, I just got to raise him. And they gave him back to me, so they didn't give me any lessons or anything on how to be the mom. And I was 18 years old, but I read books, and I thought I was doing a good job. I probably didn't. So I want to say that action of giving him up for adoption was my greatest shame for many years. I was so ashamed that someone would find out that I had done that.
Uh-huh.
I'm not ashamed now. Now I think it was a really brave thing for a young girl to do. But for most of my life, I felt like, wow, how could anyone do that? How horrible. You know, I'm a bad person because I did that. So, so I went back and got him, and there I was, the mother of a little baby son, single mother. His father didn't want anything to do with it. And then I'd lived alone with my son for a little bit, and my grandfather asked me if I wanted to go to school and live with them, live with grandparents and go to school. I was already going to school. I had never stopped. Every single semester I had taken a class at one or another junior college, depending on where I was. And I always kept at it. And he said, well, come on, you know, come live in Long Beach and go to school. And so I got accepted to UCLA, which I was really pleased with. And I moved in with my grandparents. But it didn't work out very well because my grandmother had lung cancer. And she got very, very sick right away when I moved in and needed physical care. Not to mention taking care of Grandpa, who had Parkinson's disease. So I kind of fell into an ugly place and took care of dying people. They both did die eventually. Within a year and a half, they had both died. But then I went to UCLA, and that was a wonderful, wonderful thing for me. I totally bloomed when I got there. And what I wanted to be was a writer. What I wanted to learn how to be was a writer. But I didn't want to take writing classes. I wanted to read all the great stuff written in English. I thought that was the best way to learn to be a great writer. And so that's what I did. I studied British literature. And, and it's in my notes, it says, I rewrote Love's Labor's Lost as a feminist play. Did that at UCLA. I was kind of a feminist. And there was a literary magazine called The West Wind, and they published every piece of writing I submitted to them. They really liked my stuff. And I graduated, believe it or not, magna cum laude, with my 7-year-old son in the grandstands. So that was an achievement. I'm so proud of that I continue to wear my college ring to this day.
Really, really?
I look at it and I think, well, I'm strong, I'm brave, I can do anything when I see that ring.
I'm glad
and
to hear
then
that.
I go... Do you want me to continue into my adulthood, or did you want to stop? And
I think it's a good time to break.
I know
I still have some questions and some comments. So, if that's all right, if we take a break, and
yes,
I actually just wanted to actually make two comments on the first part of your story, and just from the moment you were born. And your mother had pneumonia, and you were just put out in the hallway in the hospital, and then you developed these boils, and nobody would pick you up. And I've learned about, you know, so much in my own healing journey and about just how crucial the first 3 years are of a child's life in terms of forming that attachment with another. And I'm hearing you tell this story, and I'm thinking, oh, my heart is breaking, because I think that's just talk about just an inability at the very beginning to attach to your mother, you know, to have those bonds formed. And so that was just, that just made my heart really swell, Annie, when you mentioned that. And just to hear, you know, even where we are at the stopping point right now in the first segment of your story. Sorry, are you there?
Oh, I'm sorry. Shall I continue? Yeah.
My phone is acting up, and I apologize.
Okay.
So I just to know that you've accomplished, you know, to know so far what you've accomplished in terms of, you know, getting a graduating with them. I'm a UC graduate myself of UC Davis, and just those educations are top notch. It's a tough school, just what you've accomplished. And so, but the other thing I wanted to mention was, what struck me was you had mentioned in the sixth grade, so you had felt that, you know, you were full of sin, you had all these sins, and you were compulsively washing your hands, and that you,
yeah,
there just came a turning point where you almost realized, your mind almost shut down and said, I can't wash this away, you know, I can't, I'm going to be damned, and you stopped washing your hands, and then you stated from that time you didn't, you almost dissociated all the memories up to that point from your childhood.
Yep.
And I found that so profound because I was at that age myself, and I was molested by my father, but also it was very, very violent, and I was in a very violent beating to the point where I could have lost my life. And my first line of defense was to try and fight him off, and he overpowered me. He was 100 pounds heavier. And when that didn't work, I remember dissociating. I remember feeling, okay, my first line of defense, this is hopeless. And then I dissociated. And so when you were explaining how your mind realized, I'm not going to wash away this thing, you just, it sounds like you dissociated, I just went, wow, you know, is there a turning point in terms of dissociation where your first line of defense doesn't work and you just go, you know, that's a child's way of protecting themselves is just to dissociate. So I just found that very, very interesting when you mentioned that, you know, you just had that realization that the sins were not going to fall off. They kept accumulating no matter how much hand washing. It wasn't going to work, and you just, and then all of a sudden your memories just erased. So that was profound to me.
Mm-hmm.
So, I appreciate
you
sharing that.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So, yeah. And clearly they did come back later on. So those were just, I guess, the two comments that I had. And I just wanted to, you know, remark on them. And thank you for sharing them because it's helping me just to hear your story and to realize that some of my experiences were, you know, we're not alone in this. We're not alone.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. And I'd like to jump in this time if I can, and have some comments and some questions too. Annie, thank you so much for being here tonight, by the way. I can't tell you how impressed I am with your story so far, and I can't wait to hear the rest of it, you know. But while I have a quick second, you know, talking about this is that it's so much of NASCA's, you know, profile to have people just like you on the show, you know, and it's such a privilege, you know, to know what you've accomplished, you know, since those early days and everything. But, you know, if anyone out there is listening right now, you know, we have a huge story here. It's a beautiful story. And if you want to call in, you can call into the show. You can remain anonymous if you want to. And I'm going to give you that phone number real quick. It's area code 646-595-2118. And please, you know, feel free to talk to Annie tonight and if you have any questions or comments, okay? And Annie, listen, I'm so impressed with how far, you know, that you've came in your life, you know, all the way, you know, through today. But, you know, going way back and we're talking about these early life, you know, days, and the fact that you were put out in the hall, like Penelope said, you know, and also going to the priest in the confessional and then having to go back to your dad, you know, after that and being so confused, you know, that is a world of confusion that I don't think anybody could really, you know, cope on to know which direction to go at that age, you know. So, you know, mm-hmm. I can definitely see, you know, where things, you know, turn for you later on. And then, you know, again, you know, having to go through the adoption and everything. I do commend you for that, by the way, because, I mean, I'm sure that was probably one of the hardest times ever, you know, in your life. But, you know,
yes.
What I was going to ask you a question of, though, is, you know, usually a lot of people have different times when a lot of, you know, repressed memories come back, okay? And for some mm-hmm. people, it's in their 50s. Some people, it's in their 60s. I've seen some people within years, you know. Was there a certain time in your teens, in your high teens or low 20s, that you started remembering some things from your childhood?
No, no.
Okay.
Not until my late 30s.
Okay.
When my
okay.
sister called me up, one of my sisters called me up and started talking about
uh-huh.
it. We had never talked about it. It hadn't crossed my mind. As soon as she started talking about it, poof, I remembered everything.
Really?
And I was really shocked and
mm-hmm. uh-huh.
and upset about it. But
I can understand.
Talk to anybody about it. I didn't, you know, what are you going to do
mm-hmm.
when you suddenly remember something like that?
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't do anything for a long time, and when I finally did, it was because someone else told me that had happened to him.
Okay.
And when I heard that had happened to somebody besides me, it was like, oh,
mm-hmm.
that was news to me. And I wrote a poem about the experience, and I gave it to him. And that was my first communication.
Mm.
With people about what
that's,
had happened.
That's when you
that's
when you really realized that you were not alone. I think that's what
yeah.
it sounds like to me. You know, and that's what's so good. You know about NASCA too, Annie, is that you know just like us here tonight. You know, we know we have each other. We're a family. You know, and that's
yeah.
the thing about coming forward. You know, I know it's a hard time for people, but. You know, the platforms that we have here through recovery and prevention and intervention and all of it here, you're the prime example of why, you know, NASCA exists on this earth. And it's really a privilege to hear your story. It really is, you know. And I can't wait
Thank
to hear
you.
The rest of it for sure. You know, so, yeah. But, yeah, you know, a lot of people I wanted to throw in, too, was that you said you were in your late 30s, of course, you know. But I want to tell you that, for a lot of sex abuse, you know, victims that are out here in the world and survivors, the average age is 52, okay? So you were actually pretty lucky in some sense, I'll say, to come out at that age. You know, some people don't even see that until their late 40s and 50s, you know? So
and they
what
live with
after that?
All the consequences. What happened
yeah.
after that? Well, I want to say that after – I did very – well, socially in college, as far as my social anxiety, which I have, did
mm-hmm.
pretty good. But then after college, I just went in my house and hid. I just hid. And I didn't get a job. I had a child. And by then, the father of my child was moved in with me. And so I had mm-hmm. him. And I began to behave like, you know, a housewife. I cooking and cleaning and doing laundry, never left the house. Someone else had to do the grocery shopping.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just really terrified of everything. And that is gone now. I'll have to
mm-hmm.
say, I never thought that would leave, but look at me talking
well, when
to
you
guys
you
on
were...
the radio.
Yeah, when you say you were terrified of everything, can you give us some details about what you were terrified of most, maybe, and the way things your
I
life was going?
I thought that the FBI was after me. I thought they were outside
huh?
my windows looking in, and
mm-hmm.
I thought they were going to arrest me and put me in jail. And I saw people who weren't there. My boyfriend at the time, he dragged me out of the house and made me go to the video store with him. And I wouldn't get out of the
uh-huh.
car. And as I sat in the car, I saw someone coming toward me. And he wasn't
uh-huh.
there. That wasn't real.
Gee,
so,
well.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's one of the things that you see. I recently visited a behavioral center in St. Charles Parish, Louisiana, okay? And these people are wonderful. I'd like to give them a shout-out, by the way. They see this all the time. You know, and one of their questions that they were, you know, telling me about and explaining what they asked the people there is like, do you have visions of seeing, you know, other people, so to speak, you know? Mm-hmm. So so you telling me that it's really true, huh? Yeah, I mean, it's very possible because they seem to be asking that all the time from what I hear. Mm-hmm. And what do you think caused that, trauma?
Yeah. Excuse me, I was really out of touch with reality. And I think it's related to the brain twist I had when I was going into the sixth grade where I suddenly forgot everything. I think my brain was messed up by the abuse.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's definitely a known fact. And we talk about this all the time on the show, and it's no secret that you know, and I believe this in 100% of sexual abuse patients is that, you know, at some point it's brain damage. You know, it really is brain damage. And it's how it's perceived and how bad it is. And there's certain types of PTSD and therapies and all. But I can see, you know, how your life has developed way beyond that, you know, which is really impressive. So, yeah, let's get back on your story so we can hear the rest of it. This is getting really good.
Okay. So eventually I had to, I had to get a job. And that wasn't easy for me, but I did. I got a job as a teacher. Now, why didn't I get a job as a writer? Because I had no idea what I was doing, and I had no idea how to get a job as a writer. And I saw an ad in the paper for substitute teachers, and I thought, well, I could do that. And that began my 20-year career in teaching. It was more than that, I think, yeah. It was basically my whole life. And it was hard for me because, excuse me, I'm going to have a sip of water.
Yeah, take your time.
Okay. It was hard for me to be a teacher. I wasn't afraid of my students because I ended up in adult education. So all my students were over 18. Uh-huh. Well, actually, some of them were 16, but not a lot of them. It was, you know, it was for adults. And I felt like, okay, I can be an equal to these people. But, boy, to the other teachers, I felt like a fraud. I felt like a poser. I thought I was the most stupid person in the world. And I was terrified of the other teachers. And I had a fun job, though. I ended up designing computerized learning centers where students would come in and there was software on the computer that would teach them things. This was a long time ago, so if you remember those early educational programs.
Right, so would this be actually in literature, in English literature, or what was it in, or just all-around stuff?
It was all around. My credential was in adult education, which let me teach all basic level of high school subjects. And so I had geography and history.
GEDs. They were getting like GEDs and stuff like that? Okay.
Yes.
Okay, yeah. I understand now.
Yeah.
Okay. That's great.
Yeah. So I enjoyed it, but I got sick. And I got really sick, and I kept working for a lot of years anyway. They diagnosed me with fibromyalgia, which I call the incest disease because I hear so many people have both fibromyalgia and a history of childhood incest. And so I got that, and I tried all kinds of different remedies like acupuncture and vitamins and, you know, regular drugs and everything. They couldn't help me at all.
Right.
And I finally fell on the floor in the classroom and couldn't get up. And that was the end of my teaching career. I went out in a blaze of glory with an ambulance.
Oh, did you really? Oh, wow. Wow.
Yeah.
You know, I can testify to that, Annie, is that, you know, I also have fibromyalgia. And I tell you, it's at times that there's no way that you can literally function correctly in life, you know, if you have that at full blast. I mean, there's no way. Because there's nothing that helps you with pain. All you can do is try to match the symptoms. But there's so many of them is that, look, you know, you're burning up and your neck is frozen, you're swollen, you know, you can't move around, you're locked up. You know, how are you going to treat all of this at one time and still function on Earth? It's not going to happen, you know. But, yeah, I see where you're coming from with that. I'm sorry you have that too, baby, because I can definitely, you know, be empathetic with that one, you know. Those are my worst days.
So, Annie, I have a question. So when you were experiencing this fibromyalgia and you collapsed in the classroom, was this before or after you were able to bring forth those repressed memories?
After.
It was after. Okay. Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. And then I didn't do anything about it, like therapy or anything like that, until after I actually couldn't work anymore. And they put me on teacher's disability, which is better than government disability. And and it was really a good thing because I started to write. And I had always wanted to write, but with two kids and working and all of that, I had never done it. And I started to write when I came home. I didn't get out of bed much for a long time, but I just sat in bed and I wrote stories. And I, among my artistic projects, I built a website. And I thought this was a really good idea. I called it deadpedophiles.com. And I thought that was great.
I like that.
It was a place where if your predator was dead, you could go on there and put a picture of his gravestone or something and write pedophile across it and make it public that person was a pedophile. And you would do that on my website. I thought it was a brilliant idea, but my therapist at the time, she thought it wasn't such a great idea. I don't know.
Well, we've talked about doing the same thing, Annie. Believe me, you're not alone on that one. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we actually had pictures of quite a few of them. You know, there's a few down here in New Orleans, and one in particular wound up raping 26 kids, you know. And he is dead now. He just died about 2 years ago, right, after, I guess, 50 years, almost 50 years of molesting children. Yeah. Finally got caught and arrested and convicted, and he died. no jail time whatsoever. Yeah, but we were thinking about doing that with his grave. That's true. Yeah.
Yeah.
And
we heard it's only a
$250 fine. That's worth
it. Is that
it.
Right?
Yeah, that's what I heard.
I was thinking of doing it. I could do it to my father's grave. I thought about that.
Like carving it in.
So, Annie, you have to then stop this artistic project then at your therapist's recommendation?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand that question.
Did you have to stop this? So you started this artistic project website where with the grave sites and the predator written, you know, people that had deceased, you know, predators, molesters, you know.
I didn't keep it. I think I still own the URL though, in case I want to do it again. But yeah, no, the therapist, when she read the website, she says, we need to work on your anger. Apparently it was a very angry website, which is okay. But work on your anger. Then after I retired from teaching, I went to a therapist for the first time to talk about the incest. And that was a huge, big step for me. And the therapist said, there's a program you can go to and talk to other survivors. And I thought, oh, wow, that's super. So I went to, it was a 12-step program for survivors of childhood incest. And I discovered that there were other people. And I ended up being closer to those people than I have ever been close in my life, mm-hmm. the people who I first was able to share with. And
yeah.
I heard their mm-hmm. stories, and I hated their predators, you know, for them.
Mm-hmm.
I was just so mad at them for hurting, you know, my friend. And eventually it turned into, wow, I'm so mad at my dad for hurting me. You know, instead
yeah.
of blaming mm-hmm. myself all the time, I finally got mad. And
mm-hmm.
I think that was a big step in healing, was getting angry. So this group that I was in it for years, and then at one point I started up a telephone conference meeting. Remember those telephone conference meetings? Everybody would call the same number, and then you'd
oh, yeah.
commence talking. It was like, yeah.
yeah.
So I started one of those for four childhood incest survivors, and I did that for like a year or two. And what I really wanted to do was a daily meeting. And so I decided I would do a daily meeting. So every morning at 8:30 a.m., I would have a 12-step meeting for incest survivors on the phone conference line. And we did that for a while, and then we said, hey, why don't we have a noon meeting, too, and a 6 o'clock meeting, too. And so we ended up running a lot of meetings on the phone. And
mm-hmm.
we even had conversation time, although conversation time was tricky because things would be said, you know, fights would happen. In the meetings, you would share your story, and no one was allowed to comment on it or reply to it. It was sacred. You just shared your story, and other people
mm-hmm.
shared their stories. And so we developed this 24-hour phone line. Well, I mean, it wasn't really 24-hour, but people used it like it was. They would get on there and do conversation, like 2 in the morning, that kind of thing. But we had meetings during the daylight hours. And so I did a lot of the support work for this line, like getting moderators and speakers and all, you know, all the things you have to do. And I was on every single meeting for 4 years. It was my life. That was what I did.
Mm-hmm.
I even did a newsletter to the people who were calling in, because they'd give the email address, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the phone line listening, all those stories, so many stories, it really went deep in my heart that this was not my fault. I was not guilty of anything. And I had
mm-hmm.
a right to be angry at my father. I'm still angry at my father. Not viciously angry anymore, but
mm-hmm.
I'm still angry. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So then, should I keep going? You don't want to stop?
I think we're breaking. I think we've been having
yeah.
a conversation that let's keep going. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, the last section that I have that I've prepared, like, you know, wrote out and everything, is about writing about incest. And so the first person I mentioned already that ever told me that he was a victim, I wrote a poem about that. And then a little while later, it's like a couple years later, the poem morphed into a short story, just this little short story. And then it developed into a theatrical play. It was called Say a Few Words, and it's a revenge drama. Mm-hmm. And I published it myself. I published it under my own name, and so there was no secret anymore about who had been a victim of childhood incest. Me, I was. And it was
mm-hmm.
on the book, and my name was there, and here's the story. And that was a huge step in my recovery, the getting rid of the anonymity. in the 12-step program, anonymity is a key principle. You know, you don't break anonymity. And that's great, but I feel for my healing, I had to start talking out loud about it and writing and publishing out loud about it. And that helped me heal. Then the next thing that happened was I was the associate producer on a film for a client of mine, a writing client of mine was a film producer, and he asked me to do it. And so I got to make a movie, and that was a really amazing, although kind of unpleasant experience. And while we were doing that, I handed my play to the producer. And he said, "You want me to read that?" "Yeah, I want you to read that." So he went and he read it. And he gave it back to me, and he said, "Wow, awesome. Let's do the movie." I said, "Okay, let's do the movie." And he said, "Yeah, but you have to rewrite it." He wanted childhood. He wanted to see the childhood. My play was only a little bit of flashback. But in the movie, he wanted to see what actually happened. So I rewrote it. And I gave it to him, and he said, "Oh, no, I couldn't possibly do this movie." He was just totally shocked and couldn't handle it at all. But luckily, there was another producer on the film, and I gave it to him, and he said, "Yes, let's do this movie." And so he and I were working on it right when COVID hit, and that sort of threw a wrench in everything. But I'm ready to begin again. And the biggest step for me is to get someone to fund the movie. And that's, so that's my job. That's what I'm working on. And after I wrote the screenplay, it occurred to me that I had always wanted to write a book. So I turned the screenplay into a novel. It wasn't really hard because I had all the dialogue already in the screenplay. All I had to do was, you know, describe things. And so we did that. I did that. And a friend of mine who is a publisher read it and wanted to publish it. And his publishing company is called Impact Driven Publishing. They only publish books that change the world. That's like their little motto, books that change the world. And so they published it, and it came out a year ago. And that was pretty amazing. That's really amazing to me. And then after it came out, and before it came out as well, I started to do podcasts talking about childhood incest. And since the book has come out, I've done quite a few of those, and I enjoy doing that. And my next goal is to start, now that COVID has died down, so is to start doing in-person presentations, like around town, like at the women's groups and, you know, the Chamber of Commerce, that kind of thing, to let people know about this problem. Even if they don't want to hear about it, they're going to hear about it.
That's right. Well,
so that's about all I have.
Well, I just have to say, you know, what an amazing testament to you that even from, you know, the very beginning of the show and basically the very beginning of your life, you, despite the events that happened to you so early on that you didn't have any control over, you had this vision from a very early age of what you wanted to do. You wanted to write. You had, you know, you had that agency, and you saw that really incredible. I mean, that has come to fruition for you. And as we know, because we're survivors, the work. You know, when we write a book, when we write an article, when we produce a show, when we, you know, that is the fulfilling part. The fulfillment is there, right? This is life's work. This is meaningful life's work. And when we take action, we help ourselves and we know we're helping other people. But I just think that your story is absolutely incredible. And your book and the movie is called The Ugliest Word. Am I correct?
That's right. Do you know what the ugliest word is?
Incest.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the ugliest one.
Because
it sure is.
It is. I've had people run away from me when I said that word. It's true.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It is true. It is true.
And you know,
Go ahead.
Annie and Penelope, you know, she's talking about how, you know, she was actually there for 4 years, okay, running that support group day after day, year after year. You know, that takes somebody that is dedicated for life, that takes somebody that is going to be patient, and it's somebody that has experience, okay? And unfortunately, we all have that experience that we didn't choose to have, but we were given. And, you know, and I'm sorry for the background noise. However, you know, some of the best things that ever happened to me was actually getting with other survivors, just like you talked about, Annie. You know, because I run a support group. I have my own agency also. And the same thing with NASCA is that I think one thing we can all agree on is that when somebody actually decides to come forward, or even if they have come forward, you know, I have ever found was to bond with my brothers. You know, and I have several of them now. You know, we like family. We rely on each other. And if it's one thing that I think that we found that we never had was that word, trust. We do trust each other, you know, in what we say, okay? So that's that thing that goes a long way with, you know, being, you know, in confidentiality with what's being talked about. So, you know, that's just why I want to share that is because I'm just trying, you know, to help people see that coming forward could be the best thing that ever happened to you in your life, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the more that you hold it in, the longer it's going to be before you see that you are not alone, that you have so much potential out here, platforms available. But there's another thing that's out here for you. It's love, okay. And that's the one thing that these people desperately need, you know. And the only way they can get it is from other people that are just like them, you know. And in order for us to, you know, help spread the word of that is that that's, you know, why you're here tonight. You know, that's why me and Penelope, along with several others, we do the podcast every single night of the week, you know. And we also have Zoom meetings on the weekend. All of this, you know, is exactly what you're saying. And it's such a beautiful thing to hear, you know, again, because you are a living legend of it, you know. I mean, you are a prime example, no question, you know, and that's why you're here tonight, you know. So I want to just bring some of those features out, you know, of how you've impacted a lot of people over your life, you know. And I know that Penelope and I do the same thing all the time. And it really is wonderful for us, you know. And I want y'all to know that people are coming forward, that you all are actually helping us heal at the same time you're being healed, you know. I need you to see that. I need you to listen to it. I need you to absorb it. And I need you to make it a reality, you know. And the only way you can do it is to pick a phone up. Is to reach out and you know, find someone that you can trust. Now, let me ask you this. Over your years, have you gotten into special kinds of therapy that you did like or didn't like, or what about therapists?
Yeah, I went through a lot of therapists and didn't find anyone that helped me in any way until I found a cognitive behavioral therapist who helps me a great deal. And so I think the other ones tried other kinds of therapy. I don't even know. I just know that this guy does cognitive behavioral therapy. And he'll give me wise advice about, you know, I'll tell him what I'm thinking about and he'll give me a wise direction. And I really appreciate it.
Right. So
I did EMDR.
Basically what you're saying there, Yeah, EMDR is another one that I was going to bring up. But basically what you're saying is that you actually reached out to someone that specialized more in the area that you needed itself instead of an overall type therapist. So let's say depression or anxiety and things of that nature. You reached out to a specialist on your own situation, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
And now there's more and more training for therapists in trauma. You know, I see it on Facebook. They offer classes for therapists to learn about trauma and sexual assault and that kind of thing.
Right.
Great.
So over the years, and I want to ask you too, over the years, and I'll let you go on from here, is that what have you seen in the difference of as far as to education that's available before and now, and so the justice system before and now?
I'm sorry, that kind of broke up. Could you repeat that?
Yeah. What I wanted to ask you is, you know, in your experience over the years, is that what have you seen difference in from the therapist available back then and the therapist that are available now, and also the justice that was done, you know, back in the 70s and that kind of stuff versus the justice now?
Yeah. Well, I think there's a lot more justice now because back in the 70s, you didn't dare say anything to anyone because would make you bad. You know, it would make the victim look bad.
Right.
And you just didn't say anything. And I
think
even today, a lot of people don't say anything for that reason, that they're afraid it'll make them look bad.
Right. Do you remember early in the show, I talked to you about that grave situation, right? And that particular deacon, he wound up raping 27 kids overall, right? Okay. And this was in the 70s when it started, okay? Do you know that there was one boy, the first time that he actually got charged, okay, in 1976, okay, one boy challenged him in a court of law, okay, and lost, okay. This little boy even had witnesses, too. Unbelievable story, you know, and he was still acquitted, okay. After that, this particular individual was arrested 3 times, okay, through his career and remained in the Catholic organization until 2018, then convicted in 2019, and then he died, okay? So what I'm telling you is that you bring it up about the 70s situation. You know that first little boy that I was telling you about, 1976? That's me.
Oh.
Yeah. So you don't have to tell me about that. It's okay. You know, I needed to hear it just as long as everybody else needs to hear that. Because that, you know, this is what I'm after, is to ask you that question about what you see in the justice system now. Because I do agree that there is a lot more justice these days, you know, and a lot more advanced therapy these days, too, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I heard that there's a probe now. They can electrocute your brain, and it gets rid of depression.
That's right. Yeah, there's a lot of things out there, and that's why we just have to stay on top of our toes, you know, about getting educated, and that's why, you know, you're here tonight, and that's why we have guests every night here on Mask. It's such a beautiful thing to keep learning, you know. Don't you agree, Penelope?
I absolutely agree, and I do think that when we share our healing journey, as Annie is doing, Annie just mentioned the probe, we could apparently zap your brain to help alleviate depression. That's the first I've heard of that. So I think the knowledge is good to know that, because not every modality works for every person, but it's nice to know what's out there, what has worked, and our stories may be slightly similar, but a lot of the manifestations of the abuse are the same. And it's helpful to learn from others' experience. And that's why I so appreciate Annie sharing her experience with us, because I'm learning from her as she's sharing everything with us. I did have a question, Annie, for you about your siblings. I'm wondering if you're still in contact with them, And if you are, have they also addressed their abuse as you have and gone through the healing journey, or are they on the healing journey or not? I'm very curious to know.
My sisters talk about it, and they are, one of them especially does a lot of meetings and stuff and works hard on recovery for that. And my other sister does too. My brothers have never mentioned it. I haven't asked directly, so I don't know, except that my one brother, his partner told me that my brother told him about what my father did. So I think maybe something happened. And that's the memory I have of being told it's none of my business. That was about that brother. So, And one of my brothers is homeless. He's mentally ill, and he won't take any medication to help himself. So he's been homeless for a few years now.
Oh, that
and,
is so sad.
Yeah.
Are you in contact with your siblings?
Yes, I see my sisters often. One of them lives only about 10 miles away, so we see each other often. And then another one lives up in the Bay Area, so it's quite a drive, but we do go up there together and visit the other one.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
yeah, we're pretty mm-hmm. close. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But not
so
the brothers
sister,
so much.
Your
sister
was
like
never
you're...
abused?
I'm sorry?
It was your sister ever abused?
Yes. I probably shouldn't say that, huh? It's not...
But you don't have to answer anything here. Believe me, don't, if you don't want to. If I ask an inappropriate question like that, just say I'd rather not talk about it. Believe me, it's okay. I don't want you to feel uncomfortable. That's for sure.
Okay.
You know, I was just curious because, it's a shame that things like this actually do run in the family, and that a lot of people don't talk about it in time. But I just hope that no matter what, that you and your sister could always remain sisters of love that you should be, and don't let this get between y'all,
Right. Publishing the book, that was, I wondered how they would all take it. Not one of them has mentioned the book, except the one sister who read it and said that it was totally true, like that's how it felt, But no one else has mentioned it.
So on the actual film itself. Go ahead, Penelope.
Thank you. So Annie, I just want to finish up this one conversation. The question I asked about your family and your sisters and your brothers was really, it sounds to me though that because your sisters have acknowledged some maltreatment, have been doing the work, the dialogue is open, and that it sounds like they're on their own paths of healing and that you're somewhat together moving forward on that as sisters.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
That's,
very much
yes,
so. We're learning more all the time about what it did to us.
Yeah.
And that's where I think just the power of, that gives me hope, because the power of the fact that you have spoken and broken the silence. And at some level, it sounds like they've joined in the dialogue. And that is hopeful, because we know and we hear so many families, there's derision when some don't want to speak, some don't want to acknowledge, some want to, remain silent and don't want to address the abuse, that the families don't remain cohesive. And what really amazes me, too, is you just said, we're learning more all the time. And here you were, you all grew up together. You were in the same home, in the same environment, had probably very similar experiences. But because of silence, so many years went by, and you're finally having that communication. To me, that's just the power of the silence, right? We live these, very similar experiences within a home, But because of the silence, we're disconnected. And then how the dialogue just can help in the healing journey and can bring that connection closer. And so to me, that's hopeful, to just know that family's in that place because of the dialogue
mm-hmm.
and the work and the willingness to,
yeah.
on some level, address the truth
mm-hmm.
and the power of that. I'm also curious if is your mother still living?
No, she's not.
No.
My dad died the same year that I had to quit working. He passed away, and then my mom died 10 years after that.
Mm-hmm.
And I do have to say that before she died, my mother asked me. She said, "Did your dad ever do anything to you?" And I said, "No, I couldn't deal with it. I could not tell her."
Mm-hmm.
Even really? Though I was telling everyone else in the world, I couldn't tell her.
Uh huh.
Why?
Well, you know, it's
why
ironic too. Go ahead, Penelope.
What's that?
I'm sorry. Why do you think you couldn't tell her?
I wanted to spare her pain.
Mhm.
That was it. I couldn't bear to hurt
mm-hmm.
her.
Mm-hmm.
Even
mm-hmm.
though I didn't like her much and she was mean to me, I still couldn't do that. However, mm-hmm. one of my sisters was able to tell her the truth because she was asked the same question. So, yeah. It must have been awful to be my mother. I can't imagine.
Yeah.
She stayed with my dad her whole life.
Mm-hmm. It was clearly on her mind to me. And when I hear that she asked that question, it clearly was on her mind. It must have been on her mind.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Maybe she's, I don't know your mother.
She was very nice to her friends, but she wasn't very nice to her children. She was she was one of those people that would pick at you and she'd know all your weak points, you know? And that's where
yep.
you go. And yeah.
Mine too. Mine
yeah.
too. I hate to laugh about it, but I'm sorry. Mine too. But I still love my mother. You know, she's here today. But I do want to share with you is that I couldn't tell my mother either. And, you know, somebody else told my mother too. And just like you said, I think you probably hit it right on the head was, you know, sparing her, you know, that grief and that hardship of her own, you know, son or daughter, you know, telling something directly to their mother can be very, how do I put it, like overpowering to an individual, a young individual at that, you know, and thank God that there were other people involved, you know, getting on that too and asking about, you know, your book and the film and everything. And you have a promotional video too, don't you?
We do. We mean that mm-hmm. right before COVID, and
mm-hmm.
that was the last thing we did. And
mm-hmm.
so,
okay.
Yeah, that's we mm-hmm. got to get someone to fund it. So if anyone
right.
out there has money enough that wants to fund a movie about a little girl living with childhood incest, it's not
uh-huh.
graphic at all.
Right, right. And two, I wanted to get on the film a little bit too. Did you
mm-hmm.
on The Ugliest Word? Is that pretty much identical to your life, or did you have to change anything according to the way they wanted to publish it?
It is not my life. It's a novel.
Okay, so it's not. Okay,
and so
it's
fictionalized. A lot of the scenes in it are scenes from my life.
Okay.
However, you know, the characters are different, the events are different, and they
mm-hmm.
come from the stories I've heard from
other
okay. people. Some of the events
mm-hmm.
in there that happened,
oh.
they were true about
mm-hmm.
other people, but not me.
So basically, you're actually out there sharing stories among stories, and not only that, you're actually showing your story in the meantime. That's pretty extensive.
Yep.
That is brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
It really is.
Thank you. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. the more we talk about it, the sooner it'll stop, mm-hmm. right? I really believe so, that. I just want everybody to talk about it out loud in public.
I couldn't agree more. We need to. We're not there yet. We're so far from being where we need to be. And I'm with you on that. We've come a long way with a lot of issues that needed to be brought to the forefront, which I'm very, you know, I'm very proud of the fact that we've, as a world and as a country, we've done that. But when it comes to incest and when it comes to child sexual abuse, we're not there. And I know we're better than where we're at. I know we're better than this. And it's people like you and John and myself, but it's people like you that have the tenacity to go out and to write the book and, you know, speak the language that inspires me. And I'm here on your website, theugliestword.com. So it's theugliestword.com.
Yes.
Do you mind if I read a little bit from your website?
No, please go ahead.
Okay. So you come, if you are to go on to theugliestword.com, and there it is right there, the first sentence, what is the ugliest word? Incest. This is in big letters. There really is a monster in the hallway. Be careful. The bedroom door will open, throwing light on your face. You'll find sleep. The door will close behind your father, and darkness will descend. What if the person you love most in the world loves you too much in a way he knows wrong? How do you navigate childhood? What kind of a person do you become? And the ugly truth is one in every four human beings on earth has been sexually abused in childhood. Sometimes it's priests and scoutmasters. The large percentage of child sexual abuse is committed by parents. So, wow, that's just really profound.
Mm-hmm.
I would, if for anybody listening, and I would highly recommend, go to theugliestword.com, and you can order the book. The book is out, The Ugliest Word. You can order the book right from the website. There's excerpts from Chapter 2, and then you can also get some information on the film, on the upcoming film. So, wow, what work you've done, Annie. Thank you. Thank you for all you've done and continue to do.
And thank you. Thank you for saying that. I appreciate it. I am going to continue to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to keep on talking until everybody's talking, right?
Yeah. That's right.
Absolutely. What would you say to someone who may be listening in, who either suspect they may have been sexually abused by a parent or knows they have been and is afraid to come forward?
Well, I would say I totally understand because I was afraid to come forward too. And, there's a lot to consider, like the shame, as I mentioned. A lot of people feel shame and they don't want other people to know. But for me, that shame went away when I went public. When I put my name on and said, okay, this is it. I was abused in childhood. I don't feel ashamed of that anymore. It's the truth, and it has nothing to do with me. That was
right.
Him. It's all about him, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if I hadn't written and gotten it out there and published it with my name, I think I might still be in the anonymous stage.
Mm-hmm.
And afraid to put anything out there.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that you thought that speaking of what happened to you would bring you more shame. But when you spoke the truth and put it out for the world to see, you felt less shame. You felt more free.
Yes, absolutely. I didn't feel any shame anymore. I'm not sure why, but I didn't, and I don't. I continue to feel no shame.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt terrible shame before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and in there also, you know, she states about, you know, ashamed of the stigma. you know, which is exactly what y'all are saying, you know, and that's a great word to use, because a lot of it has to do with a lot of the taboo, you know, the stigma, all of it's right there, you know. And I know that, that you also, you know, you said you found a lot of strength in the ability to find community, you know, through different levels of media. So, and you use the example Facebook. You know, can you give us some examples on how that happened and tell us a little more about that end of it?
Yeah, on Facebook, I did a search for groups that have relation to child abuse and found many, many, many of them. And there are lots and lots of Facebook groups that are specifically for childhood sexual abuse. Not so many just for incest, but the sexual abuse.
Right.
And so what I did on Facebook was I joined all these groups.
Uh-huh.
And so when I do posts, like if I see something in the news or all different, I write memes sometimes, and I post them to all of these groups. And then I also read all the postings, and I share, like, some of the postings I see in their group. I'll post on my page. And and then the people in those groups become Facebook friends.
That's right. Yes, exactly. And have you know, and too, you talking about that, is that, you know, just ironically, you brought that same exact term up. Is that is the name of my organization, is SCSA, Survivors of Childhood Sex Abuse, you know. So, yeah, I mean, you know, and that's what it is, and that's who we are, you know. But with you going in and getting all areas, you know, which is a great thing to have, because we need to be motivated to be, you know, educated on every level of abuse, not just incest, not just, you know, clergy abuse or emotional and mental, physical, all of it, you know, because all of it goes hand in hand. If you really want to get down to the fact about recovery, you know, and trauma related issues, you know, which a lot of it all does come together in the end of being pretty similar, you know. Yeah. You know, so I'm just saying that you know, with you, go ahead.
No, it's okay, John. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interject.
No, that's fine. That's fine. I just wanted to tell her, you know, that she's, you know, really a true ambassador and a hero. And I'm so happy to have met you tonight. It's been such a wonderful story. And, you know, I'll always be here if you know, you need someone. I'm sure Penelope will, too. And all of us here at the NASCA family. We'll always be here for you. It's been a real, real pleasure listening to you. It really has, okay?
Thank you so much for saying that. I really appreciate it.
You're so welcome.
So, yes, Annie, I wish to thank you, and I wish to thank you, you know, for just your honesty and being so candid and sharing your story, especially with the work. Well, with everything that you've put forward tonight in your story, your truth in general, your book, your upcoming film. And I think, you know, what is so profound about what you just said about shedding the shame, you know, releasing that shame when you speak your truth, especially for the first time, you know, the first time you tell someone, you tell the world that you were molested by your father. Thank you for saying that, because that is such a huge part of healing. And I think that it's the shame and the fear of the stigma that holds so many people back from taking that step of actually unburdening themselves. I call it unburdening, because to me it's a heavy burden to carry when you're carrying that shame within you, when you're carrying that secret. It just weighs so heavily, I think, mentally and emotionally, but also physically. How you describe just being released of all shame when you finally were able to speak the truth and bring it out and bring it to life. I thank you for that because I think that's such a huge step. And that catapulted me into my healing journey was just finally telling someone. And I so appreciate mm-hmm. you sharing that. It is very true that the opposite of what you think is going to happen once you speak the truth of what happened to you. What happens is you feel a kind of freedom you never felt before. Instead of feeling like mm-hmm. you can never show your face again, you feel like you can show your face for the first time in a very real way with confidence after releasing mm-hmm. you're really shame. And so thank you so much for saying that because I think it's so profound coming from you and so impactful mm-hmm. to hear that message. And that message is such an important one. I believe, especially when someone's on the cusp of taking that step. So thank you.
And
the
I
way
hope
she
all
told
the
her story
listening.
Tonight, too.
I hope all the people listening will call and tell their stories on the radio show, too, because then they can unburden themselves and enjoy the freedom of not being ashamed of it.
Yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that is exactly what, you know, Annie's done tonight is coming on the show. And this is NASCA has three special guest nights a week, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, where we welcome anyone who wishes to come on the show and tell their story. This is the platform where you can come and share in a safe place. We are all adult survivors of child abuse. This is the place where you can come and speak your truth and be supported and be met with empathy and understanding. It's a safe place to come and do that. So, and I know, Annie, I believe that you have volunteered and you will be helping produce our shows now on NASCA, if I'm not mistaken.
I have volunteered to do, whatever needs to be done.
Oh,
thank you so much,
Annie.
And I'm very excited about that. I think that's just absolutely incredible. You have so much to offer, and you have so much expertise, and you've obviously given us a lot of background when you were having the phone call and conference call recovery groups, and very familiar with giving people a platform to speak mm-hmm. and to share stories. And so I'm very excited to have you in that capacity with NASCA, and thank you so much. So we have we have 30 seconds. Yes, very much so. So we have 30 seconds left. Is there like a one-liner, a few words you want to leave our audience with before I close out the show?
Oh, goodness. I wish I'd thought about this one. let's see. Oh, yes, I'll tell you the dedication to my book. It is, they threw dirt on us, but we were seeds.
Yes. Thank you.
Okay. And that is a very good point. We were going to grow, weren't we?
Yep.
That's right. Well, thank you so much. Thank you, Annie Marges. From Long Beach, California, a longtime NASCA family member, NASCA sister, NASCA volunteer. I wish to thank you for coming on and telling us your story. So appreciated by myself and I know by NASCA and I know with my co-host, John. Thank you, John, for being on with me this evening.
Thank you all, too.
Let you know the show will be archived in about 30 minutes. It can be found on NASCA.org website for this. Current show schedule. This is scan number 2793. As I always say as I close up the show, there are enough adult eyes on this planet to keep every single child safe. If you see something, please say something, do something. It is our moral responsibility. Thank you. God bless you and good night.
Good night.
Good night, everybody. Night.